We're studying the book of Exodus, and we're on page 69, chapter 24, verse 1. You have 68 on yours? Okay.
Yeah, 68.
Then he said to Moses, that he being God, said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and you shall worship at a distance. And Moses alone, however, shall come up near to the Lord, but you shall not come near, nor shall the people come up with him." Then Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice. And they said, "All the words which the Lord has spoken to us we will do." Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Then he rose early in the morning, built an altar at the foot of the mountain, 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. They sent young men of the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings to the Lord. Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And then he took the book of the covenant, and he read it in the hearing of the people, and he said, "All that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient." So Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, "Behold the blood of the covenant which the Lord made with you according to all these words." So God calls 70 elders to come up on the mountain part way only. He calls Moses to come up all the way up to meet him. Moses wrote down all the rules that God had given him. And this is, remember we talked about these 613 regulations, how they came from God? And he's not talking about the Ten Commandments here. He's talking about another set of writings. He reads them to the people ceremoniously, apparently twice. And the people committed to keep these rules and these commandments. So Moses built special altars and they sacrificed animals. He sprinkled the blood on the people as a covenantal sign. So the book of Deuteronomy, as we've talked about before, was the second reading of the law. That was the second reading of the Ten Commandments plus all these 600 rules and regs. And that was done at the edge of the River Jordan after the 40 years in the wilderness, when they were getting ready to go cross over Jordan to take the promised land. Well, it's called the Deuteronomos, means second reading of the law, or second law, second set of norms. This was the first one. That's why that one's the Deuteronomy. So this place here is the first time that God read, and Moses read to all the people, the whole list of the rules and regs that God had given them. There's the Ten Commandments, okay, 613 rules and regs. That's okay. All there is.
Yeah, but he's already given them the Ten Commandments, right? Or this is the Ten Commandments right here.
No, this isn't the Ten Commandments. This is the rules and regs. He's already given them the Ten Commandments. We had that back in Exodus 20.
Okay.
This is the additional rules and regs we were talking about here a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, okay.
We've been getting little bits and pieces of them as we go. So on this particular occasion, he calls the 70 elders to come partway up the mountain there. Then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. And under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire as clear as the sky itself. So God gave them a vision of himself. Kind of like the one similar to one that it was given to Ezekiel or Isaiah, Revelation, whatever. "Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel, and they beheld God, and they ate and drank." Now, what he means when he did not stretch out his hand, remember that he had told Moses, "If I show you myself, it'll kill you." So what he did was he extended grace to them to be able to get a vision of him without it hurting them, is what he's done here. So he's brought them up halfway up the mountain. This is a very unusual scenario, because remember, before he told them, don't come up on the mountain. This is the at this particular point in time, there's a reading of the covenant. The elders agreed to it for the people. Later on, Moses takes it back to the people, and they agree to it, and he sprinkles the blood on them. And they're getting ready to have a sacrificial meal here, as a celebration of this covenant. The word covenant is benai, and the verb for using, that you use with the word covenant, to make a covenant, is berith, which means to cut, or to cut a covenant. And the reason why that is the case is because when they make a covenant, And they take an animal, usually a big ox or something, and they slice it, cut it in two, hack it in two, and they spread the parts. And if they're poor and they can't do that, they'll take smaller animals and cut them and whatever, but they walk between the parts. And they say, if I do not keep these rules, may what has been done to these animals be done to me. Okay, and that it's a image that's meant to make an impression on them. Well, when they get done with all of that, what they do is they cook it up and have a barbecue, because throughout the Bible, there's few things holier than a covenantal meal. Remember that the Lord's Supper was a full meal way up into the first century. It stopped being a full meal sometime around the change of the century, and just became a bread and wine service. And that probably had as much to do with the persecution that was going on as anything else. But when Paul was talking to the Corinthians about the Lord's Supper, he said, you know, people bring different things, and those who come early eat everything and don't leave anything for the other people. It was a full meal they were talking about. Table fellowship is has been in every culture throughout the world a very important thing among people, especially to establish friendships, relationships, or whatever. You have a rehearsal dinner. You have a reception dinner afterwards. You have people get together at a funeral. They eat together. Table fellowship is one of the most important biblical principles. And so churches have covered dishes and potlucks and that sort of thing. When you feed the poor, what you're basically saying is, you belong to me. I belong to you. We're brothers and sisters. And to fail to feed them is to treat them as enemies. You're saying, I will not share a covenantal meal with you. So what you're basically saying is, you're other. You're not mine. You're not me. You're other. So this whole process, all of these, in the temple, in the tabernacle, only one of the sacrifices that they made out of five were immolations, which means that everything was consumed: hooves, horns, skin, everything. The vast majority of them were wound up resulting in meals. So sometimes people would bring up a lamb to give to the Lord, and they would skin it, and they would give God the hooves and the horns and the fat, and they would give the Levitical priest the right breast shoulder, and then the rest of it was cut up and packaged and given back to them. They would go home and they would cook it, and they would eat it before the Lord. They were celebrating with the Lord with their sacrifice. They would want to be in it. That's why the Levites became butchers. That's why you see in Fiddler on the Roof, you see Laser Wolf as the butcher, the town butcher. He's the Levite. He knows how to kill these animals kosher and carve them all up appropriately, and the right pieces go to the right places. And the rabbi gets the right shoulder, and there's a whole process. The immolation.
Which one?
The burnt offering. The immolation. An immolation means that it's totally consumed in fire. The burnt offering. The rest of them, the peace offerings, the wave offering, of course the grain offering, etc., etc., were wound up in shared meals. Now, one of the more interesting studies that you could get into is the Temple of Ezekiel in the Millennial Reign. And what people don't know, and I got this fairly late, but in the Millennial Reign there is a temple in Jerusalem, and it is like the temple that we have, only bigger and different. And one of the things that it's got into it is hundreds of dining rooms, small dining rooms, so that people can come up and make offerings unto the Lord. Now you say, why would you make an offering unto the Lord when you have Jesus there already has forgiven sins? And it's because it's a memorial offering, like the Lord's Supper is a memorial offering. The Lord's Supper is just the grain sacrifice of the Old Testament, because the grain sacrifice was bread and wine. Remember when we studied the grain sacrifice, you said that the bread could be eaten as a loaf, or as wafer, or grits. Remember we talked about that? How interesting that was. The Bible said grits. Okay. So, you know, I guess you remember that. Most people remember that. But the point is, the Bible actually says grits, okay? And so the point is that with that came, there was a wine thing that went on with that. So bread and wine is just a memorial offering, a remembrance of the grain offering that was offered by the people. We do the Lord's Supper now. That's like doing a grain offering, just like they did. But we do it in memory of what Jesus has done. Well, when we get to the millennial reign, Jesus is going to be ruling and reigning over Jerusalem. And there's going to be this temple there, and they're going to have all these sacrifices for the Jewish people. They're going to have all these sacrifices. And when they get done with these sacrifices, they're going to retire to all these rooms, you know, as they, you know, and eat these meals in these rooms. There's rooms for the priests and rooms for the people. And you'd be like booking a room like you would at a restaurant, you know, getting a reservation for a room for your extended family. So table fellowship and the eating of meals between God and man, and between man and man and God and each other, have been holy as far back as man has lived. And you know, if you love somebody, you feed them, and if you don't love somebody, you starve them. You don't feed them. So this is, on this particular occasion, God calls these 70 elders halfway up the mountain, gives them a special view of him that ordinarily they would never receive, and the other people didn't receive. And then they sit down and have a sacrificial meal, and they do it in order to ratify this covenant, where these people say, we will obey these laws. We'll obey the 2 laws, the 10 laws, and the 613 regs, and everything that extrapolates from them. So the point is that this covenantal agreement was no small thing, because it was accompanied by a vision of God that was so rare that it never occurred again with anybody, or before, really. And this covenantal meal between them and God, that's how important that covenant was to God and was supposed to be to them. So later on, when they get to breaking this covenant and the various rules in this covenant, it is like what happens when someone commits adultery on their spouse. Because you have this wedding, and everybody gathers around, and you make these vows, and then you have this big fancy meal, and everybody agrees and eats and says, we are all family, and we all agree with this. This is a covenantal experience that's happening here before the Lord. And we bear witness to the vows that they've made, and et cetera, et cetera. And then what happens is someone goes off and does something in violation of all of that. We consider that to be not kosher. We consider that to be a bad thing. I mean, it's going to cost you half, Eddie. You know, it's expensive, right? So the point is that that's how God feels about the breaking of the covenant. Or about the loose living of the covenant. You know, I mean, someone says, well, babe, I come home most nights, you know. I mean, those other women don't mean much to me, you know. You're the one who washes my socks, you know. That's what you call loose living. Well, that's what God sees in us. He sees people loose living, because we're not keeping this covenant that we made, at which time we walked through the halves of this slaughtered bull and said, may whatever be done, this animal be done to me if I break this covenant. Alrighty. Yes?
In verse 11, where it says, yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles, then you told us that, though it doesn't say it here, that he gave them a vision.
Oh, it does say he gave them a vision.
Well, I missed it.
Then Moses went up there, and they saw the God of Israel, and under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire, clear as the sky itself. What do you want? What more do you want?
I guess I don't.
It's a separate
line. Oh, okay.
They saw the God of Israel,
okay.
And underneath his feet, so they saw feet.
Okay.
there was this sapphire field that he was sort of standing on, sapphire cloud. If you read Ezekiel or in particular, or even some of the things like in Isaiah 6, where he's, we saw the Lord, he was high lifted up, and his train filled the temple, and the angels cried holy. So when it says he did not stretch out his hand, remember that we've talked about this before in some of other classes, but where it talks about the Lord stretching out his hand, it's always about judgment. He stretched out his hand, you know, he stretched out his hand. It was his way of judging people. We talked about that. We talked about in the study of Isaiah, because there were some chapters that got separated, and one of the reasons we knew they got separated was because he kept using that metaphor about stretching out his hand. So it's either to bless or to curse, but what it means here is he saw these people, but he did not stretch out his hand to judge them. I mean, he let them see him, but he did not stretch out his hand to judgment. So he gave them a pass on that. He gave them a grace for it. Now, that was, God didn't have to do that. That was a significant offer on his part. I mean, these people weren't expecting it. They didn't have any reason to expect it. We've already got him saying to Moses, look, if I let you see me, it'll kill you. So I'm going to hide you in the cleft of the rock and I'll pass by and you can see the back of me as I go by, right? So we already know that it's a serious thing for people who are unclean to look upon the Lord, to get too close to the Lord. And God says, well, we're going to have this covenantal relationship, and here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to let you have a glimpse of me. That was just not a small thing.
Hey, Wayne, you know, back up in the first paragraph where it talks about Moses talked to the people and they said, with one voice, you know, all the words God has spoken will believe it. He's getting ready to do the Ten Commandments. He hasn't even done those yet. So is it all the other?
Yeah, it's all the other stuff.
It's all the other stuff. Yeah. That came before the Ten Commandments.
Yeah. Actually, are you sure about that? I think Ten Commandments is Exodus 20.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. Well, I guess he's going to go back through. Maybe he can go back. I was looking over in a few.
If you go to Exodus 20, I think you'll find the Ten Commandments.
Okay. Exodus
20, verse 1, page 56 or 55.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The Ten Commandments he wrote down there, yeah.
No.
Aaron. You get Moses and Aaron.
Yeah, this is...
that's why I asked the question earlier. I wasn't quite sure we forgot.
Yeah.
Oh, there it is.
He gave them everything that's stolen down.
I wasn't hearing
it. No, it said it was written down. I assume that Moses wrote these down on animal skins or something. This would be a lot of rocks for the Ten Commandments. I mean,
well, here he gives them stone pieces. I will give you stone tablets with the law and commandments.
Yeah, but I think that's the Ten Commandments. I don't know. I'm not sure it's important exactly, but I have a hard time thinking of them as carrying all them rocks with 613 rags on them.
You have to buff up a bit.
Yeah. Well, you got a lot of Levites, so you know. What's your job? I carry 614, and I carry 610 through 613.
It is heavy.
That's right. Okay.
All right. Alrighty. So Moses rose with Joshua and his servant, and Moses went up the mountain of fire. And the elders, he said, now wait here for us until we return. Behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a legal matter, let him approach them. Then Moses went up on the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. Now this cloud is the Shekinah glory of God. It is ever present in the scriptures in ways, including up to the what happened at Pentecost Sunday. But there is this, the presence of God is, it's like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when the big ship came out of the clouds. Remember when you had all those big storms in the sky, and then that big ship emerges out of the clouds, and you realize that these aliens have been using the clouds to cover their activities, right? Y'all ever watch movies? Okay, so all throughout the these Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you have these, you know, you have these little spaceships running around playing with them and whatever. But there's all these storms, or there's all these storm clouds, big, cirrus clouds. And on this one point in time, when they go to reveal themselves on top of what is the name of that mountain? Looks like a actual mountain. It's a with a claw or something. I forget the name of the mountain. But there's this big flat-top mountain where they're getting ready to reveal themselves. It's like the storm rolls in, and then out of this storm comes this monstrous big spaceship with all the lights and stuff on it. Do-do-do-do-do. Remember that? So, the Quavers. They played the Quavers. So, anyway, that always reminded me of God hiding himself in the clouds. And that's what the Shekinah glory is like. Whenever Moses would be among the people, this is throughout their 40 years, and God wanted to speak to Moses or the people or the elders or whatever, he would descend on the tent of meeting, not to be confused with the tabernacle, the tent of meeting with the cloud. And then Moses would come up into the tent of meeting and they would meet there. I mean, he didn't go back up on the mountain anymore. And that would be, there would be, sometimes he would bring the elders with him into the tent of meeting. Once they brought in Miriam and Aaron and Moses for a butt kicking that he needed to do with Miriam and Aaron into the tent of meeting. But this cloud would come down. And now, when we're told that when Solomon dedicated the temple in 2 Corinthians 7, you know where it says, "If my people call by my name," 7:14, whether it's a 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, etc. And so in 2 Chronicles 7, where Solomon is dedicating the temple, we're told that God, in the process of demonstrating his covenantal commitment to dwell among them, comes into the temple in the Shekinah glory. And it is so powerful, it drives everyone out of the temple. And he just comes and kind of settles in, and, you know, this huge, big, monstrous cloud of fire and whatever, and cloud and fire, and he comes in. I mean, you can just see like lightning bolts all over this place. He comes in and he fills the temple, and then you can kind of see him sort of shriveling back up into the Holy of Holies, and then it, you know, the people can come back in. But when he and when it leaves that way too. So throughout the Bible, we get this picture of God's, called his Shekinah glory. The Hebrew word for God's glory is Shekinah, but it means this cloud, this pillar of fire by night and the cloud by day. That's God's Shekinah glory going with them, over them, you know, covering them. And so when we talk about the glory of God, it's manifested itself in terms of this cloud. Now, on Pentecost Sunday, what we have is the Holy Spirit coming in with a sound, this massive sound that's like a train or like a tornado, whatever. But there's not any, you know, lightning and all that kind of stuff. It's just the sound, the roar of his voice. In Psalm 29, it gets to talking about the voice of God and what it's like. And it talks about it's like many wet waters, like a waterfall. The voice of God is like all this stuff going on in the wilderness. I mean, in the forest. It says the voice of God breaks the cedars of Lebanon like lightning. The voice of God caused the deer to calve. You know, it's powerful and energetic.
Can you spell that word?
Shekinah? Shekinah. Now, that's how you would spell it in English.
Right.
Yeah.
And I read where the Shekinah glory has as its resting place in the tabernacle, the mercy seat.
Well, as long as God was in the Holy of Holies, he rested over the mercy seat. But he wasn't visible in Shekinah anymore. He was just, at least not the... The Shekinah glory is not like something you put in a bowl. It would cover a football stadium. Okay, so that's what I said. It goes into the temple and just covers this temple, and then just kind of shrinks back up into this over the mercy seat. Now we're going to get to that in just a minute here when we get to the Ark of the Covenant. Okay, so let me. How about we start about verse 13 or 14 or something like that. So Moses rose with Joshua and his servants, and Moses went up the mountain to God. But the elders, he said, wait here for us until we return to you. Behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a legal matter, let him approach them. So he's setting Aaron and Hur up in this particular visit as his delegates while he's gone. Moses went up the mountain. The cloud covered the mountain. So that cloud thing, okay? The glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. On the seventh day, he called to Moses from the midst of the cloud. In the eyes of the sons of Israel, the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. So that's why in the movie The Ten Commandments, it looked like a volcano kind of of an effect, except you don't have the running lava. But there was this huge, big fire and cloud and whatever, smoke. In the movie The Wizard of Oz, which was, remember, the first colored movie, or first movie in color in this country. In fact, what they did was they introduced it partway through the movie. Right. Starts off in black and white, and then it, okay? And that was the first time they added color to a movie. The Wizard of Oz movie was built in order to debunk religion. That was its purpose. That was the whole thing was to debunk religion. And what happened is at the end, when they finally get to Oz City, they've got this whole big cloud thing and this voice and everything. And Dorothy or one of them went and looked behind the screen, and there's this old man back there. And he's going, don't look behind the screen. Don't pay attention to the man behind the screen. What he's basically trying to say is that all of this cloud and smoke and fire and everything like that was just a big magical stage show. Because after all, there is no God, and you know, it's all a big bunch of show. And that was the purpose of The Wizard of Oz. It was not the people who wrote that. That was their underlying attitude. And they were doing it in an age when religion was big. But they were sort of debunking the whole idea of religion, because this is part of the emergence of the. We talked about this when we talked about the modern times. The Ayn Rand people and all the God is dead theory and all that kind of stuff. But that whole thing about the guy behind the curtain pumping up all the cloud and the smoke and the lights and all that kind of stuff, he was just putting on this big show trying to intimidate all the people into obeying him. Turned out to be a white-haired old man and kind of a grandfather type. And
unfortunately, most people don't understand all that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, we talk about apocalyptic writing, and we talked about Animal Farm, which is an apocalyptic writing which attacked communism. We talked about Gulliver's Travels, which is an apocalyptic writing that attacked the royal houses of Europe. And apocalyptic writing is written like a Revelation, Book of Revelation. It's written so that the people who write it can have plausible deniability, because it's written at a time when it's hostile to the existing power structures. And Book of Revelation is absolutely openly hostile to the Roman Empire and the rule of Rome and the whole world, whatever. And so it gives you plausible deniability. You say, oh, it's just a fairy tale, you know, whatever. Well, Wizard of Oz was an apocalyptic writing. So it wasn't the first, won't be the last. Then Moses went up on the mountain, the cloud covered the mountain, the glory of God rested on the Mount Sinai. Okay, see, the eyes of the sons of Israel and the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. And Moses entered the midst of the clouds, went up the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. So then the 70 elders, Moses, Aaron, his two sons, went up, and God gave them a glimpse of him, but they were spared from harm. They celebrated a covenantal meal before the Lord, a Lord's Supper. Then God calls Moses up to receive the stone tablets, but this is not the first time they've had stone tablets, okay? Because remember back in Exodus 20 is when he had the first set of stone tablets, and he came down and he threw them down and smashed them, you know, whatever. So He took Moses, Joshua with him and commanded the elders to wait for him. He places Aaron and Hur in charge in his absence, and he disappeared into the Shekinah glory. There's one way you can spell it. She left. Moses waited in silence for 6 days, and then God appears on day 7. This it was common when Moses went up on the mountain that he would have to wait for God to speak. Sometimes weeks, he would just go up and be before the Lord. He's up there for 40 days. All right, Exodus 25:1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Tell the sons of Israel to raise a contribution for me. From every man whose heart moves him, you shall raise my contribution." So, go out and tell Israel, I want you to take up a collection, and people should give as their heart moves them. They should give freely. So, give, don't give. It's up to you. "This is the contribution which you are raised from them: gold, silver, and bronze, blue and purple and scarlet material, fine linen, goat's hair, ram skin, dyed red, porpoise skins, acacia wood, oil for lighting, spices for anointing oil, for the fragrant incense, onyx stones and setting stones, for the ephod and for the breastpiece. Let them construct a sanctuary for me, that I may dwell among them. And according to all that I am going to show them, all the patterns of the temple and the pattern of the tabernacle and the patterns of its furniture, just you shall construct it." So God said, "I want you to build me a place that we can use as a church, as a place of meeting, where we can all come together, and I can come and dwell among you, and you can come up to visit me, etc., etc." So this is like the people say, let's build a church, and everybody get out what money they have and donate it as they will. Now, one of the things we'll find out is that the people gave themselves freely to this. Of course, you know, you just had a situation where God's been showing the elders who he is and all this kind of stuff and whatever. But the people, remember that when they came out of Egypt, that the Egyptians literally threw money at them. Well, these people are wandering around the desert with all kinds of gold and silver and jewels and whatever stuff. And so God is saying to them, "I want you to collect, I want you to gather up all this kind of stuff, because I want you to build something for me. And what we're going to build is a tabernacle and a bunch of stuff that goes in it." So if you're on page 145 of the Rose Book, then you'll get a good look, and there's a lot of detail on the following pages. But that's what, she's got a book right over there. That's what, you don't have one over here? You got one?
Well, I've got to find out which one it is in here. I'm sure it's in here. This has got a cutaway of it. Is it like this one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's close. That's close. There's more stuff than that, but we'll get to all that. So God's calling for a building program, and in this building program, remember we've been talking about these 600 rules and regs and how the Lord has very specific information he's trying to convey to them about morals and how to think and how to what to value and all sorts of stuff. Now he's getting ready to build for them, get them to build for him a place for him to dwell among them and a place where they can come up to meet him. Remember, coming up with the mountains, getting them killed. So he wants to put himself in a place where they can have fellowship back and forth. But he wants it built, and he wants it built a certain way, and he wants them to understand that these various things that he's telling them to do, they have meaning and purpose. It's not just arbitrary, that there's purposes to these things. And as we talk about them, we'll get there. So he's calling for a huge offering and a huge building plan. Now, they can't leave Sinai until they got this thing built. All right. So God tells Moses to raise a lot of money from all the people. They need to build a tabernacle and the worship-related items. The people give money, goods, or services. And all of what follows is actually repeated verbatim again in 35 to 40. Almost verbatim. "So they shall construct an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits long." Now, what he's talking about right now is the Ark of the Covenant. So, in your drawing, you can see the Ark of the Covenant in the Holy of Holies. You got a picture of that?
Yeah, we've got it covered.
Okay. All right. You can see the Ark of the Covenant and the Holy of Holies in the far end there, the western end of the tabernacle. And you see all that white smoke and everything above it? That's supposed to be the Shekinah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Pages later, it shows just the Ark. 152.
Now, if you go over to page 149, item number 7 down there is a good look at the Ark. And then if you go over on page 153, you also get another look at the Ark and some information about the Ark. So as we talk about it, you can kind of have that visual. And we'll be doing a lot of this going forward from here. All right. You should construct an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, and 1.5 cubits high. You shall overlay it with pure gold, inside and outside you shall overlay it. You shall make a gold molding around it, and you shall cast 4 gold rings for it, and fashion them on its 4 feet, and 2 rings shall be on one side of it, 2 rings on the other side of it, and you shall make poles of acacia wood, and overlay them with gold, and you shall put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark to carry the ark with them, and the poles shall remain in the rings of the ark. They shall not be removed from it, and you shall put the ark of the testimony, which I shall give to you. You shall put the put into the ark the testimony, the tablets and the book of Moses goes in there later, the book of Moses, the testimony that I shall give to you. Okay, now, you all remember the story about Saul and Jonathan being killed by the Philistines, and they captured the Ark of the Covenant. And the Ark of the Covenant got put in one Philistine city after another, and the false gods kept falling on their face and breaking, and they had breakout of mice, some infestation of mice, and all the people got boils, and so they wound up, you know, putting all the gold mice and boils in the thing and putting it on a new ox cart and sending it home. The Philistines did. They said, if this is God, we'll build a brand new ox cart, take 2 virgin cows and hook them up to this thing and put this thing on there, and if it goes home, we'll know it's God. And if it wanders around aimlessly, we'll know it's not God. So it goes home. And when David hears about it, then he gets all excited and he comes down to pick it up, and they bring it on back toward Jerusalem. Well, as they're going along, the ox stumble and the cart tips, and the thing starts to come off of it, and a soldier named Uzzah reaches up to grab it so it doesn't fall, and Uzzah gets struck dead. And David gets angry because he said, he's just trying to do a good thing, Lord, and you struck him dead. And the Lord said, I told you, you're never to touch this thing. Okay? And David's upset about it. And so he takes it to the house of some alien and parks it there because he doesn't know what to do about it. Well, the reason they got into trouble was it wasn't supposed to be carried on an ox cart. It was supposed to be carried on poles by Levites. And they're supposed to know that. And you know, they get sloppy, and this is what happens. So once David sees that the alien whose place he took it to was prospering, dramatically prospering, he said, well, I guess it ain't all bad. And so he goes and gets a Levitical family to come and pick this thing up. And they put it on the poles, and they take it to Bethel, or I think Shechem, one of them, whatever. And it resides there for a while. And then they move it from there to the threshing floor of Arunah, which David buys at full price for his own money, and that becomes the basic floor of the temple. So, but this whole issue about the ark is that it had rings on the sides that were supposed to be carried on poles, and you can see that in any of the pictures here, but you get a really good look at it on page 153. You see those. Now, there's this whole gold rim around this thing with these big ring-like things for these poles to go in. And these poles are made of acacia wood overlaid with gold. So is the ark, by the way. So that thing's supposed to be carried. And there is a family that does nothing of Levites. It does nothing but carry the ark. So we study Deuteronomy or Leviticus, Numbers. We get that presentation as well, who they are. Okay. So the Lord instructs them how to construct the Ark of the Covenant. It was largely as was portrayed in the Indiana Jones movie. The acacia wood is an orange-brown hardwood found in the Middle East. The box measured 45 by 27 by 27. A cubit is 18 inches. It's actually the distance between your elbow and your and the end of your wrist, which for most grown men was about 18 inches. There were actually two cubits, but the regular cubit was about 18 inches. There's a royal cubit, which was like 27 inches long or something, but or 24 or something like that. But there is a... So this box is measuring 45 inches by 27 by 27. So it's not huge. Okay. It was covered inside and out with pure gold and gold molding. Two rings on each side were used for the carry poles. Carry poles are made from identical materials. Carry poles are meant to be always remain in the rings. In fact, if you look at on page 153, you see that they are showing it. In fact, anywhere they show it. They show it with these balls on the end, so you really couldn't lose the poles. You see what I'm saying? These,
yeah.
So they're not, those poles aren't supposed to come out of there. All righty, here they go. Ten Commandments, stone tablets were stored there, along with the Pentateuch, which comes in later, when Moses gets done writing the five books of the Bible. His book, once it's finished, goes into the Ark of the Covenant. The rod of Aaron, after Aaron is dead, and a jar of manna, all are items that they were told to place in the Ark. You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold, 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, and you shall make 2 cherubim of gold, and make them of hammered work at the two ends of the mercy seat. You all remember the movie Ten Commandments when Aaron is making the golden calf? Remember how he's taking sheets of gold and then hammering them in until they mesh in, and then new sheets of gold hammering them in? That's what hammered work means. It means they take gold and they melt it into sheets, and it's usually around some structure, wooden or metal. And then they beat the gold until it sort of blends and mashes in. Fire, it's hot, and then they sort of beat it into shape. That's what hammered work means.
When does it say in Scripture that the Pentateuch got in there too?
Later in the Scriptures. Somewhere in there it said when Moses finished the book, they put it in the Ark of the Covenant. Let's see here. Where am I? Oh, hammered work, okay. You shall make 2 cherubim of gold, make them of hammered work at the two ends of the mercy seat. Make 1 cherub at one end, 1 cherub at the other end. You shall make the cherubim of one piece with the mercy seat as it's at its two ends. So this is all a big... The lid of the thing includes the cherubim, okay. And the cherubim shall have their wings spread upward, covering the mercy seat with their wings and facing one another. The faces of the cherubim will be turned toward the mercy seat. You shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark. In the ark you shall put the testimony, which I will give to you. Well, there you go. And there I will meet with you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the 2 cherubim which are upon the ark of the testimony, I will speak to you about all that I will give you in the commandment for the sons of Israel. So, God doesn't live in the box. He lives above it. He hovers above it. So the mercy seat was the lid of the Ark of the Covenant. It had the same materials and the same dimensions as the box. Cherubim are winged angels, and are also called living creatures. Now there's cherubim and seraphim, and they're different, and they have different purposes. The seraphim are 6-winged living creatures. cherubim are four-winged living creatures. And they, one of them is all about the worship of God, and the other is to do God's the work of God. Cherubim are winged angels, living creatures, always associated with service to the Father. They drove Adam and Eve from the garden and were set up as guards over the tree of life. Lucifer was a cherub, which is the single form of cherubim. So are Michael and Gabriel. Their wings reach inward from both ends of the lid and form a throne or seat upon which God was rested. This was the physical location of God on earth until it was replaced by the man Jesus in the hearts of all believers.
Is all this a man? I mean, God is a spirit, so he's, I mean, is this for their purposes, you know, largely to sort of...
God said, I will dwell in this place.
Okay.
Now, he's sort of hovering above this place. But no, this is as serious as a heart attack. And what happens is that when people walked in there who shouldn't, they fell over dead. When the high priest would go in once a year to make sacrifice, they would wear bells on the hems of their garments, so that if they went in and their sacrifice was insincere and they fell over dead, they would throw meat hooks in to drag them out, because they couldn't go in and get them. Medics can't go in and get them. Yeah, well, then no, they listen for the thump thump and then the stopping of the bells. Remember that even when Zachary was making his offering before the Lord, the people listened for a long time because he didn't come out. He was in the holy place. He wasn't even in the Holy of Holies, because they were afraid something had happened. And then when he came out and he'd been struck dumb, then they knew something had happened while he was in there.
Who was that?
Zachary, the wife, the husband of Elizabeth, the father of John the Baptist. So, all right. So if you're on page 153, you're getting this picture of these angels facing each other with their wings coming forward and creating a kind of a plane, as it were, upon which the Shekinah glory is resting, which is above the seat. Okay? So that's where God told them, that's where I will physically dwell among you as a spirit, but I will be there. Remember, God's not in the hearts of the people. It's not like, you know, the Christian church where the Lord's in the heart, in our hearts. He wasn't in the hearts of these people. And so he said, I will dwell among you at this particular place. So I want you to build this thing. I want you to build it exactly like I tell you, because I'm a holy God. And I want you to build it. And all these things represent something. You're using the finest of materials. You're building it in total obedience. You've got my cherubim servants are, you know, there the whole nine yards. Okay. Now you shall make a table of acacia wood. This is another one. This one we're going to find on page 145, and it's exhibit 6. It's when you look at the Ark of the Covenant, it's in that little smallish room at the end, which is the Holy of Holies. Then there is a curtain. Now, if you're on page 145. Bob?
Yeah.
Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, there's a curtain there. You can see the purple curtain at the end. Mm-hmm. And in front of that, there's a table. That's the altar of incense. This table, it's kind of a little square thing. It looks like a podium or something. And you see those rods, those holders, the poles? Okay? All right. So, I want you to make a table of acacia wood, 2 cubits long, and 1 cubit high, and 1 cubit and a half high. You shall overlay it with pure gold and make a gold border around it. You shall make a rim of a handbreadth around it, and you shall make a gold border for the rim around it, and you shall make 4 gold rings for it. Put rings on the 4 corners which are on its 4 feet. The range shall be close to the rim as the holders, the poles, carry the table. You shall make the poles of the acacia wood and overlay them with gold so that with them the table may be carried, and you shall make its dishes and its pans and its jars and its bowls with which to pour libations. You shall make them of pure gold. You shall set the bread of the presence on the table before me at all times. So the table was made of the same materials. It was 36 by 18 by 27 high. I think it's actually number 5.
Wait a minute, are you talking about 5 or 6?
It says number 6.
I'm talking about, it's number 5. It's number 5.
Right.
Yeah. It's number 5. This stuff is to scale, so it's number 5. Yeah, that's right, because this is where all that was. Okay, all right. It's known as the bread of presence or the showbread, and other items to be offered to the Lord. It had rings and carry poles and gilded acacia wood. Okay. Then you shall make a lampstand of pure gold. A lampstand in its base and its shaft are made of hammered work, its cups. And this is the 7-branch candlestick, number 4. Okay. And this is a pretty interesting piece, too. The lampstand in its base and its shaft are made of hammered work. Its cups, its bulbs, and its flowers shall be one piece with it. And the 6 branches shall go out from its sides. 3 branches of the lampstand from its one side, and 3 branches of the lampstand from the other. And the 3 cups shall be shaped like almond blossoms in the one branch, and a bulb and a flower, and 3 cups shaped like almond blossoms in the other branch, and a bulb and a flower. So for 6 branches going out from the lampstand. And the lampstand, 4 cups shaped like almond blossoms, and its bulbs and its flowers. And the bulb shall be under the first pair of branches coming out of it, and the bulb under the second pair of branches coming out of it, and a bulb under the third pair of branches coming out of it, and for the 6 branches coming out of the lampstand. Their bulbs and their branches shall be of one piece, and it shall be one piece of hammered work of pure gold. Then you shall make its lamp 7 in number. Lamp 7 in number. They shall mount its lamps so as to shed light on the space in front of it. And its snuffers and their trays shall be of pure gold. They shall make it a talent of pure gold with all these utensils, and you can see that you make them after the pattern for them, which was shown to you on the mountain. So, 7-branch candlestick was made of pure beaten gold with a center holder for oil and 3 additional holders on each side. That's where you get 7 branches. Okay. The holders were shaped like almond blossoms with bud ornaments. It was all beaten into one single construction, no pieces and parts. The snuffers of the tray were also pure beaten gold. The reservoir filled constantly with holy oil hovered above it. So you get they don't really show that very well. But there's actually a thing that's above it that's constantly pouring oil down into it.
Wayne, haven't all these been built recently in Israel?
I have no idea.
I've read that.
Have any of these things been found, or did those anybody know
No. No. All this stuff disappeared. It would have never made it through the Crusades, for one thing, because they were stealing everything in sight. But it all disappeared. During Jerusalem was collapsing, it is believed that Pharaoh Necho came and took the Ark of the Covenant out and took it to the treasure city of Tanis, which was the slave city of Ramses before that, and that's where Indiana Jones found it. That's in the movie. What I'm trying to say is Indiana Jones was, the movie used accurate data. The movie, the Ark, the late Raiders of the Lost Ark, used very accurate data and constructs, including the "don't look at it" thing and the melting of the faces and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, was the Shekinah glory over the Ark when the Philistines were?
Oh no! The Shekinah glory had already left the temple.
Okay.
You know it.
Huh? The temple.
Yeah, for years, for decades, the Ark of the Covenant was in the temple with no Shekinah glory at all. God left the temple because of the unfaithfulness of the people. And when he leaves the temple, it's pretty ugly.
Okay. So that's kind of when those pieces lost their value, so to speak.
Huh?
I mean, from God's perspective.
When people quit keeping the covenant, he left them.
When in Revelation it talks about the Ark of the Covenant being in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
we don't know. Theoretically, it's supposed to be in a warehouse somewhere in Washington, D.C.
But nobody really knows where it is.
Nobody knows where it is.
Yeah.
But the it disappeared at the time of the Babylonian captivity, and the Jews believed that the people who fled Babylon to go to Alexandria took it with them, and that it was captured by Pharaoh Necho.
Sure does sell a lot of books.
Shishak, not Necho. Shishak.
When the Levites were responsible for carrying the ark, what's this baby weigh?
It's not. It's. You know, four men can handle it. I mean, it's not that big.
It just seems like it would be heavy with all the gold.
Yeah, I mean it's not that big, but I mean four or I don't know, maybe they had eight men on it, but
four.
So they can handle it.
Well, the gold is hammered for one thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's thin, covering the acacia wood.
Well, it's covering the wood. Yeah. So you know, I mean, if somebody can carry a fat man in a coffin, you know, if you got six pallbearers carrying those, you know. I guess they can handle this.
It's 7.5 feet by 7.5 feet and 4.5 feet high.
What's that?
7.5 feet by 7.5 feet is a square.
What are you talking about?
That's not right.
No. It's 45 inches by 27 inches by 27 inches.
Oh, wait, here it is. Page 1.
Yeah,
she's looking at something.
It's 3.5 feet long by 2.25 foot wide and by 2.25 foot high.
Yeah.
On page 149.
That's not very big at all.
No, it's yeah.
I'm slightly confused. If there was a time where the Ark of the Covenant was deadly if you didn't carry it by things, but yet it supposedly landed in the hands of people who were
the Philistines,
and
it killed them.
Oh, it did.
Oh, yeah. They kept sticking it. They kept putting it in their temples,
okay.
And it killed people who came in. They came in and found their gods down on their face, broken and shattered. The entire people, got infestations of mice and boils, and so they moved it from one temple to another, thinking this other god would have a better luck with it. And it brought a plague of death and destruction upon the Philistines. So they said, we got to get it out of here. And so they tried to figure out how to do that. And so they made 7 golden boils and 7 golden mice, which they made as an offering. And they put it in this thing, and they stuck the whole thing on a cart they made with wood and drawn by 2 fresh milch cows, as it says.
Is that the last known...
No, that was way early back.
Well, I guess what I was trying to get to was toward the end where there were numerous things that happened and it disappeared. Did it disappear in the hands of...
Well, that's why they said... that's why they said that the Levites probably took it to Alexandria with them with the poles. I mean, but, you know, once you know, if Pharaoh gets a hold of it, I mean... You know, accidents happen on the work site, right? I mean, another thing is the Bible tells the story about when it was kept away, in the first place where it was kept, is people kept going down and looking at it and dying. They kept going and lifting the lid and killing over dead. The Bible tells the story.
Where was that?
The first place that it landed after Remember when Uzzah, whatever, and David stuck it at this one place?
Oh, okay.
So what happened is that it was a problem, and so they got to researching it. They figured out they needed Levites. So they got some Zadokite Levites to come down and take it with them to Bethel, and they knew how to handle it. So, you know, so it was... All right, so the reservoir filled constantly with holy oil hovered above this seven-branch candlestick and continuously fed the seven oil lamps to keep them always burning. It was a single vial of this oil that miraculously lasted 8 days, and that is the Feast of Hanukkah. Now, the story here is that in 175 B.C., Antiochus Epiphanes, the Seleucid lord, king, desecrated the temple. He put a statue of Zeus in the temple, and he sacrificed hogs to it. Turned the temple into a slaughterhouse of hogs. And it took about 3.5 years, or 1,100 and however many days it is, 25 days, whatever it is, 2,300 divided by 2, 1,150 days. Took 1,150 days, which is about 3.5 years, of guerrilla warfare for the Maccabees to drive the Seleucids out. And after they did, they went to consecrate the temple, reconsecrate the temple. And when they got ready to light the seven-branch candlestick, they could only find one vial of oil. And it takes something like 30 days, when you read Leviticus and Deuteronomy, where it talks about the making of the oil, there's a very distinct formula for how you make the oil and what you put into it and all nine yards. And it takes about 30 days to make this oil. And so what happened it takes 8 days to make this oil. They only had one vial of oil, but it miraculously lasted for the 8 days it took to make more. And that event became known to the Jews as the Feast of Hanukkah, or the Feast of Lights. So when the Jews celebrate Hanukkah today, they're celebrating the fact that in 175 or 172 or what BC, when they got ready to rededicate the temple, they had this miraculous thing with the reestablishment of the seven-branch candlestick.
Isn't it amazing, like, the detail? I mean, the detail is incredible.
Well, we're just getting started. I'm just getting warmed up.
But, you know, also, some of the covering is going to be porpoise.
We're getting ready. We're going to get there.
So, but I'm just amazed that God knew that they had all this stuff, but just the interesting...
Well, they had to go get porpoise. Sure.
Well,
in the sea. They would capture porpoise and... Well, I mean, you know, they probably had some porpoise skins around, but they probably just went and got new porpoises, new porpoise skin. So when you look at the detail, like she said, you're stealing my thunder. God waited 2 chapters to tell him that, Nancy, but you had to go ahead.
You lifted the lid.
The dark.
Yeah. You struck it.
Okay. I'm on page 73 or 72, whatever you're on. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's kind of scary when you think all the detail that God has gone through, that he's not overlooking all the little bitty things that we do.
Yeah, well, that is the issue of God's grace. Now, but you remember, what God is trying to convey to this people is, I'm holy, I need to be obeyed, I need to be treated with extraordinary respect. I am above you. I'm latitudinally higher than you are. I'm your God and you're my servants and my people, and you must obey me and honor me. Now, once people get the right kind of attitude, then we can be friends. See, he and Moses were friends, but it was because Moses honored him. When people get to dishonoring him, he's not friendly anymore. Right? So... we are expected to understand. We Israel was expected to understand clearly that God is holy, He is sovereign, He's transcendent, and that He needs to be obeyed and honored at a very, very high level. So this, I think I'll screw whoever I want, doesn't quite cut it with God. I mean, we have other events going on here. Like, for instance, Nadab and Abihu, who were two of Aaron's sons, got careless about mixing the offering of fire and offered strange fire to God, and God struck them dead. And then he told Aaron he couldn't mourn for them. So he's trying to make a point. He has not dwelt among humans before. I mean, remember, these people are getting a lot closer to him than Abraham was. These people are getting a lot closer to him. God is sort of making a move to come and dwell among men in a way that he did not with Abraham or Jacob or even King David or those kind of people. You know, I mean, I'm sorry. The people before this, anyway. But the Noah, whatever, he is making a move to come and dwell among them. And then, so many years, 1,400 years later, he's sending his son to come and dwell among us in an even closer relationship. So he's kind of moving toward us and trying to prepare us as he goes for all of that. So this reading of these Old Testament chapters and books that seem to be, you know, kind of tedious, there's a method to this madness. Okay. All right, I need to read this next section. God gives Moses specific instructions for the construction of the tabernacle. The tabernacle was the tent-like structure that functioned as a portable temple for Israel. So this is the tabernacle. These walls around it are the walls around the tabernacle. But this is the tabernacle. Okay? It's the Holy of Holies and the holy place and the tent and everything that covers it. And then these walls are part of it, but they're an ancillary part of it. So it functioned as a portable temple for Israel from Sinai, their founding as a nation at Mount Sinai, until Solomon built the first permanent temple in 970. So from 1290 to 970, they have the tabernacle. Its material and structures were quite complex and very specific. It replaced the temporary tent of meeting first used by God as a place of contact between himself and Israel's leaders. So when they first start out, up until this time, there's this tent that God told them to set up as the tent of meeting. And it wasn't to be used for anything at all but for Moses to meet with God or the elders to meet with God or whatever. The tabernacle then becomes a replacement for all of that as a general place for all the people to live and dwell with God. Now, let me finish reading because you'll get a better picture. One of the reasons I did this summary up front is because if you go through this little at a time, it could take you weeks to get to the overview. All right. An overview of the tabernacle's physical structure is given next because the sequencing here in the scriptures is confusing. And the details are spread out over the next 14 chapters. A good picture can be found in the Rose Book 144 through 151. The tabernacle was 10 cubits wide by 30 cubits long, or 15 feet by 45 feet. The tabernacle included the Holy of Holies and the Holy Place. Now, the Holy of Holies is a 15-foot square, and the Holy Place would be 15 by 30. Because the whole thing is 15 by 45. It did not include the larger structure, the courtyard. The courtyard, the people referred to the tabernacle, and sometimes they meant that including the courtyard. It's like the temple. The temple, if we go to... Okay, if you go to page 161... There is a picture of Herod's temple. And the temple itself is actually this big, tall structure right here. Right here. All the other stuff, the courtyards and all that kind of stuff, they're not actually the temple. But they're the courtyard of the temple. And so when people say, let's go up to the temple, they sort of think about all, mean all this other stuff. The fortress of Antonio over here is not part of the temple, but people think of it as the temple. Are you with me? So the tabernacle is that little central tent there that's 45 by 15. Yeah.
She's asking where's the fortress?
You said over on the thing about the temple, there's a, you see that fortress of Antonio?
No.
Is that the wall that goes all the way around?
It doesn't go all the way around, it's only on one side. Oh, you're not in the right place.
Oh, figures.
Oh, right here. That's Fortress Antonio.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah, the Fortress of Antonio was actually a Roman garrison that looked down into the temple. And there was a lot of stuff that happened over that. The Romans once hung some eagles on that thing, and it caused a major brouhaha.
Can you hold yours up so we can see? We can't. I don't know what we're talking about.
You said they called
This is the Fortress of Antonio. I'm a field on this. I'm just making the point that when people talk about the temple, they often mean the whole big complex. So like, for instance, if you're in the Holy Land and you're talking about the restoration of the temple, all you're really talking about is this building right here, this little square building or oblong building. You're not talking about all this other stuff. That doesn't have to come back. Just this little thing here for the temple to come back. Well, the same thing is true with the tabernacle. The tabernacle proper is just that little tent thing, 45 by 15. All right, let me move on here. The tabernacle included the Holy of Holies and the Holy Place. It did not include the larger structure of the courtyard. It only opened facing east at all times. Its only opening faced east at all times. So the tabernacle is on the western wall, and so the opening is east, down at the far left-hand side. The wooden framework was made up of 46 planks, 15 feet by 2 1/4 feet. There were 20 planks on each side and 6 planks on the western end. There were 2 additional planks, 9-inch planks, on the western end as well. All planks are made of acacia wood covered in gold. So you have to have these planks, and then they have to be sort of roped together, held together. 4 separate coverings created a roof over the structure. The first layer was blue, scarlet, and purple linen with cherubim on it. So the first layer was blue, scarlet, and purple linen that had these pictures of the cherubim on it. The second layer was pure white goat's hair. The third layer was ram skin dyed red. And the fourth topmost layer was from porpoises or badgers. And why was that? Now, if you look at this, cutaway that you see here, if you look down toward the end, you can see layers shown there in the cutaway. But a better look at it is on page 147. On page 147, you see here on the hides of sea cows, that's on the top layer, ram skins dyed red, the goat hair is the third, and then the layer closest to God is this fine twisted linen, blue, purple, and scarlet yarn with cherubim embroidered by skilled craftsmen. Now, when they got ready to build this thing, they got their most skilled people to do all this kind of stuff. And it had to be, you think about people doing needlework, right? So this had to be absolutely right on. Let me move on. I'm trying to get an overview here. Let's see here. And the topmost layer was of porpoises or badger skins because they want to keep the rain out. Porpoises are pretty good about keeping water out. The tabernacle was divided into 2 rooms, the Holy of Holies and the Holy Place. The Holy of Holies was 15 feet square. It contained only the Ark of the Covenant. A veil matching the first layer of ceilings divided the two rooms. So if you look at the veil, see that veil? You can see it on page 147, and it's exactly the same material, same patterns as that first layer of, you know, with the all that sort of thing. That was the veil that gets cut in two or torn in two when Jesus dies on the cross. It's a balustrade curtain. It probably weighed several hundred pounds.
I said it lasted, didn't you say 320 years? Was how many years this was used by?
Yeah, well, it was.
Probably didn't wear out.
I cannot honestly say if they made a new one for the temple. I can't say that. Because the one in the temple could have been a different one than the one in the tabernacle.
Yeah.
The tabernacle and the temple stand apart. So I can't say that. The holy place was 15 feet by 30 feet long and was entered from the east. Okay, so once again, if you look at that little box and go down to the end, it's really hard to see because the spirals are right in the wrong place. There may be a better look at it somewhere else. But what you actually have there is an opening, and there's a curtain in front of it. And I'm talking about the holy place now. There's a curtain in front of it, and people went through the opening in the curtain. Anyway. Yes.
Churches still do a lot of that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. The how they position on the lot and everything. That's just a throwback from this kind of a detail around the temple. Churches used to always or often be made like that. The big emphasis on the direction they sat. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, they're a little better about that now. When I was a young altar boy, only the sacristan would ever come back there, who would be a woman. But now they have altar girls and that sort of thing. At any rate, so on the western wall of the holy place, of the western wall of the holy place, which is, now we're going to look at number 7, okay? Western wall of the holy place was the altar of incense. On it was burned the morning and evening sacrifice. This is the one that was ceased during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, the morning and evening sacrifice. It was acacia wood overlaid with gold. It was 18 by 18 by 36. And that's what, you can see that. And you see the rings, the poles. Look at number 7. It's number 6, which is below number 7, which is the curtain. See number 6? And it, you know, it looks like a podium. That's, and that's actually where Zachary was offering the incense when he was there. When he met the angel. Alrighty, let me see. Let me move on here before we get to that. On the northern side was the 7-branch candlestick, and on the southern side was the table for the bread of presence. The table for bread of presence was the one we talked about earlier. Surrounding the tabernacle was the courtyard, 70 feet by 150 feet. Its walls were 7.5 feet high and made of linen cloth panels spanning 7.5 wide and hung off of pillars adorned in silver and brass. There were 20 pillars on each side, 10 in the back and 6 in the front. The opening was covered by a screen set forward with the entry on either side. That's what I was saying about the opening in the courtyard, is that you had... it actually, there was an open, when it said there's only six pillars in the front, it's because the curtain came, I mean, the wall came around and stopped. And then forward of that, they had another thing that stood there, and the people would go around it in order to go in. So you had a visual block, but you didn't have people would get through it. Let's see. The opening is covered by a screen set forward with entry on either side. The screen was 30 feet wide and centered in front of the opening. The curtain panels were connected in bronze, not gold. The tabernacle almost touched the western wall of the courtyard. So when you look at the tabernacle, it almost touches that back wall. Okay? In Ezekiel's temple, there's a huge room here. It's not here in this thing here. The eastern part was the altar of acacia overlaid with bronze, and the laver, the wash basin used to in the eastern part, it was used to clean bloody hands and sacrifices. So you see there, number 14 is the altar, and number 15 is the laver. Now in the temple, that altar is way bigger and much higher. And that laver, where the water is, that is called a sea of brass. It's huge because of all the water they need. But they got to carry these things, and so these are sort of dumbed down in size. Because every time they get up to go somewhere, there's a family that does nothing but carry this stuff. So they tear it down, set it up. And when we get to talking about their moving and all that kind of stuff, after a while you're going to see why all these Levites were necessary, because you literally had thousands of people whose job it was to unpack all this, take it down, disconnect it, carry it forward. In fact, as we in here in just a second, we're going to talk about where all the tribes were around this thing. And there is an order of egress, so that when they get ready to move, you have this one group that goes out, and then the Levites with the temple go out, and then the other tribes come behind, so that when the people finally get there, the Levites have already got the tabernacle set up. So there's all this detail to that. The curtain panels were constructed in, two families of Levites were responsible to tear down and rebuild the tabernacle. The tribes camped around the tabernacle and marched in a designated order. The first grouping on the east were Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. The second grouping on the south were Reuben, Simeon, and Gad. The third grouping on the west were Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. And the fourth grouping on the north was Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. So I'm gonna stop our thing here tonight there and talk about it a little bit just more. But all right, we're not going to meet next week. There's not enough people want to meet. And so it'll be 2 weeks from now. Somebody figure out what that date is. Ninth. So 9/9/13. Okay. So now if you look at the page 144, 145, you can see outside these tents are all set up. And there's designation about the various tribes and where they are. Now, also in closer inside, you can see where various people are operating, like the families of Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Eleazar, and Ithamar. They are operating all in this particular area here because they're the priests. The sons of Aaron and his descendants were the priests. They did the sacrificing. All other Levites did not do that. The sons of Aaron did that. The other Levites do things like pack up things, carry things, sing. They're the choir leaders. They've all got these jobs. And some of them are indicated here. You got the various families. Kohath, Gershon, and Merarite are the three families of Levites. The Kohath, Gershon, and the Merarites. You can see them if you go around, the three families. And it says like Numbers 3, whatever. That's where all that stuff is designated, Numbers 3. And then the priests, the Levites who were priests were the families of Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Eleazar, and Ithamar. And that's where they lived, right there by the eastern gate. So that's the kind of...
You know, when you see that map and you think about the pillar of fire kept them warm at night and shaded them in the day, there are 2 million of them. I mean, you talk about the vastness of it, you're talking huge Shekinah glory.
Yeah, you're talking...
Hiroshima.
You're talking about a controlled environment, right?
Yeah.
Well, it also says their clothes didn't wear out, their shoes didn't wear out.
That's why I'm thinking that... Because the tabernacle was used for 320 years, wasn't it? It seems like I did that math in my head.
Yeah.
So I bet it didn't wear out for those 320
years. No. They never had to replace it.
Amazing.
In fact, the tabernacle was used... Yeah, because that was to the day of the temple.
Yeah.
Yes.
And for the temple part...
900 and something, yeah.
That thick, and just tear them its own from top to bottom.
Yeah.
I can explain that away.
Well...
I mean,
well, you can't, but you know, it's you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound.
Yeah.
If you're a believer, you believe in all of it.
Yeah.
If you're not a believer, you don't believe in any of it.
That's right.
So, other comments? Bruce, you got comments?
Nope.
Okay. You're the scientist among us, I thought. I think that there's all kinds of things about this to take into consideration. One is that this is a lot of detail. And why? The question is why. And the answer is because God's serious about what he wants done, how he wants it done. All of these things, as we see as we go along, are going to have they're going to have certain implications or metaphorical meanings or meant to teach us things. But one of the things it's meant to teach us is that God is serious about us walking with him in holiness and doing the right kind of things. And when we walk humbly before the Lord and we're obedient and we do things, his grace covers our mistakes, as it does often in situations we'll see. When we get sloppy and we don't care anymore, we just go, whatever, the grace disappears and all of a sudden consequences are the result of our mistakes. Some things are... You know, there's a lot of things that happen in the Old Testament that are pretty stark when you read about them, but there's reasons for it. There was one rebellion in which some of the people decided they wanted to worship the Amorite gods, and one of the guys took a Amorite whore. And married her and took her to his tent, and they were having relations when everybody else was trying to worship. And what happened is God was withholding himself from them until Phinehas got up and took a spear and ran to the tent and ran it through the both of them and killed them. And God gave Phinehas props because he cared enough about the holiness of God to deal with that. Now we look at that and we go, daggone, you know, I mean, that's a serious reaction, you know. You know, we're sitting at church trying to sing and nothing's happening and somebody gets up and goes out in the parking lot and shoots a couple kids making love in the car. You know, I mean, alright, now we can worship. You know, that's how it strikes us, you know.
Yeah.
But these people dwelt in the presence of the living God in ways that we can't even imagine. I mean, he went to battle for them. He provided manna every day and pigeons every day so that they could eat. He brought water out of a rock for them. They were wearing clothes that didn't wear out. They were this is Disney World. This is their relationship with God. The way they lived and dwelt before the Lord was supernatural. And in the midst of all that, he was angry at them half the time.
Because they complained all the time.
Yeah, well, they did.
But you know, they won such victories. So the Philistines saw that these victories were accompanied with the ark. That's why they wanted that ark.
That's why the Philistines wanted the ark, yeah. And that's why, according to Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, Hitler wanted it. That's why he wanted it. And which, by the way, is partially true, because Hitler was very much into the occult and was actually looking for stuff like that. Hitler had this whole vision of this a Nordic Superman, God, Aryan God man. Some of the stuff that, some of the artwork that he had done was.
If you look at him, he was anything but Nordic looking.
No, he wasn't. But it's funny because he had this huge painting done that was like 10 feet tall of this enormous warrior. Massive warrior with his face on it.
Alter ego.
Yeah, okay. Somebody pray this out.